Hey, welcome back to the We Are Explorers podcast. Today's episode is an interesting one. I'm chatting with Rick Peterson, who is a contestant on Alone Australia Season 2, which, as we all know, is actually in New Zealand. So, a bit of an interesting one with the tech. Rick's internet wasn't quite good enough to do the normal podcast recording, use the app that we normally use. So we tried a phone app, it didn't work. So ended up just saying, well, I just want to talk and, you know, give me a call on the phone and I'll put it on speakerphone and record it. So that's what we did. Phone reception was okay. Might be a few little spicy bits, but overall, really interesting chat. Rick was in the army for a long time, 15 years plus, SAS, and now he runs survival courses. And he's just, you know, for all of the gnarly kind of stuff he's done, jumping out of planes, you know, going survival, that kind of thing, he's just such a affable, friendly guy. And I'm really excited to share it with you. We talk about his experience with Indigenous Australians as well, and a bit of a learning journey that he went on, which is really important. And I think probably the highlight of the chat for me. So enjoy. I'm calling from Cammeraygal country in what's now Northern Sydney, or called Northern Sydney. What country are you on today?
I'm up here on Gubbi Gubbi country. Yeah. Been up here for about 12 years and operating in and out of here and to different parts of Australia. But yeah, Gubbi Gubbi country.
Oh, wonderful. And so your early life was spent on Tasman Island. Your father was a lighthouse keeper. Can you tell me about that? Do you remember much of it?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think when we look back at our past, especially those very early years, we have images of things, but you're not sure whether you've developed those images through conversations and hearing stories or whether they're actually real. But I do have a couple that I believe were real. And having recently, like, we left the island in 1967, and so last March, at about this time of year, we managed to get back to the island as a family. So it's all automated now. Nobody lives on there. And so after 55 years apart from the island, myself, my sister and two brothers flew back to the island to volunteer. And it's like stepping back in time. Nothing had changed. The old three brick homes and a lighthouse that's on the island. And we were the only family living on the island at the time. So incredible to go back and reminisce all those early memories. The smells, the sounds of the wind, all the small things.
Yeah, it's always a bit sad when you go to an old lighthouse and you see it's just a computer running the show.
Yeah, it is in some ways. I mean, it's certainly, it's run by solar now, but to look at it, it was identical to how we left it at the old lighthouse from 1906. It was built, so it was standing as strong today as it was back then. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. So they only recently have been, you know, really working on getting some volunteers back there to do restorational work on the island itself, and that's how we got the opportunity to, and an invite to go back to the island for 10 days. And I was doing a lot of weed eradication, and my brothers and sisters were, you know, helping with the catering and restoration work on the lighthouses. So a really great way to be introduced back to 55 years.
Yeah, it must have been crazy. I saw, like, your family kind of all, you know, were raised separately. So it's amazing you're kind of still all in touch and can come back to that island.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, we certainly had those quite a few years separated as children due to being raised up through as a ward of the state as foster kids. And we all get on really well now. We have lost two sisters, but those of us still here, we love getting out for a walk or going like a bush trek or a hike and, you know, being able to get back to the island and, in essence, I suppose, give back to the island that gave us so much as kids. Yeah.
And after that, you grew up, you joined the army and you moved to Townsville and then the Top End. My first question there is, do you hate the cold?
No, I think at that time of the cold, I love the cold, but it's about making sure you're prepared for it, for sure. But I love the heat as well. I've spent time out in the Pilbara with different military units and, you know, places overseas that can get, you know, quite stiflingly hot. But there's that element of, if you're prepared for it, you're smart with it. It's really good to live on those sort of edges of those extremes, I suppose. Yeah.
What is it about Northern Australia that you love so much?
I would say it's the rawness of it. I mean, I definitely had a stronger connection to culture up there. So I think it's seeing it, a lot of it through their eyes, you know, when you get to the different seasons. So in Gungaju, and the traditional people of Kakadu, one of them groups is Gungaju, and they have a seasonal calendar. So at the moment, we would be in their season of Gujuk, which is all the heavy rains, and, you know, all the crocs are laying their eggs and all different sorts of things happening in the environment. You're very close to it. You're witnessing all this happening around you in perfect sync with the indigenous seasons, you know, whereas ours are rigid to the day, our months, our seasons, but theirs, it's fluent, it's constantly moving and changing. So, yeah, the love of the plants and animals up there and the culture is my attraction to the top end.
Yeah, I was thinking the other day, people were saying, you know, it's very hot for March, but, you know, realistically, it's not a real season.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. And I think the further we are removed from that cultural presence or taking the time to understand that side of things, the more we are removed from, yeah, and it's confusing having the, you know, the banter about the seasons and changing weather. I'm not saying it's not. I'm obviously very aware about where the world's at, but the smaller, minute changes in and amongst the environment are really good to witness.
I watched a really great TikTok you posted about Australia Day, and you talked about your interest and understanding of Aboriginal culture and how it's developed. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, I say that to some people, because when you're looking at paths that we take, that sliding doors, decisions you make and where our belief systems are. And, yeah, I was certainly growing up in Tassie, apart from knowing that our Indigenous, you know, play didgeridoos, had corroborees and things like that, very genetic, stereotypical things that we know, culture, but then to leave Tasmania not knowing anything, really, and then joining the army and being posted to the council, I got to see, I guess, the other side of the culture that is quite fronting, where there are economic problems, like the country, but I might why it was the way it was. And so, you know, I was down that path to being probably as racist as anyone around me and not having an understanding of it. They might approach you when you're out with the boys having drinks, you know, they're probably looking for money for whatever the reason might be. I mean, it's very easy to, I suppose, be judgmental as to why they are and leave with derogative comments. And it just didn't sit well with me. So I suppose I took it off my own back to the studies at James Cook University, and I started to really realise how did we know. I think it's a book called Why Weren't We Told, but incredible book that really helped open your eyes to the world and its greater, in particular where it is today, where we don't differ.
Yeah, exactly. It's a process of unlearning, isn't it?
I remember like guiding a lot of places in Central Australia in the top end when you unravel bring two, you know, if I'd like 5 meters represent 5,000 years, and then you put a little knot as how long our flight is have been here, and it's like, now we're telling you what to do. that time span of every 100 million, 1,000 years, like a lot of time on country is for it's good and working, but repairing mistakes. Yeah, it's not about the blame game. It's about what can we do to improve our relationship, understanding of each other's culture.
Yeah, and as well, like, what do you think we can learn from Indigenous Australians about, especially things like hunting, bush tucker, and survival?
Yeah, definitely. When I'm running my events, I guess one of the first things I do is, especially people are standing to fall, they find the soldier and all the survival instructional skills to the military. They're not necessarily new skills to the military. The military didn't come up with them. So many of those are based on the ethnobotanical knowledge of plants, you know, whether you're using it for food, whether it's medicine, whether it's, you know, to make cordage and things that you need, you know, it's that sort of knowledge is easily lost if we don't hold on to it. You know, I'm thankful that the military was able to share some of that with me, but I learned so much more when I got to spend time out on country. One of the units I served with after the time at the SAS Regiment was about North Force top end. There's a lot of experts from out on the island. I was down in Whitey or Bullander in my patrol, and the rest were Binion. They were Aboriginal. They were able to spend time out on country and go hunting with them, but at the same time, they learned how military tactics of observation and communication and first aid and navigation, that they're tuned into their own navigation. They sort of don't need ours.
Well, that's, and like in the military, what kind of roles were you, you know, attracted to in the army and the SAS?
Yeah, I suppose when I first joined the army, it was about getting getting away from an environment where I was, I suppose, somewhat disrupted from leaving school early to joining the army. So being around solid role models was a big aim. And then after a couple of years in the unit, in the 1st Battalion up in Townsville, an infantry unit, I then heard about this other unit called the SAS Regiment. I hadn't heard of it up until that stage. And there was a documentary came out by a man called Simon Ackerman. It was called Battle for the Golden Road. Mm. And I sat documentary and it created an itch that I needed to scratch. It was like, well, I can prove to myself and some of those back in Tassie who I suppose to a degree had something to prove that I wasn't just going to be a rat bag as a kid, and I was quite a rat bag. I can prove something here. So I thought I'll give this SAS unit my best crack. And it was in 1986, and I went on to spend about 8.5 years with the Australian SAS Regiment in an aerial operations role, which is a lot of jumping out of planes, but also a lot of helicopter work, rope work, needed demolition, survival, medical communications, languages, all sorts of skills that you acquire over the next sort of 16 months after getting in. But yeah, it's a great bloke's playground. For sure, you get to work hard and play hard and do all sorts of crazy stuff that seems very unusual to, I suppose, mainstream civilians. But yes, it was a job at the time. Yeah.
Yeah, like if people are wondering if the military is right for them, would you say that's the sell?
It is. I think it's like any position you take on, regardless of the job. You know, you attempt to really enjoy what you do. And if you don't enjoy what you do, then it becomes laborious or you become disgruntled with it and you end up, you know, sharing your complaints with everybody else and not doing anything about it. You know, so the military is that if you go in there, go in with the intention of being the best soldier you can be or being the best, you know, operator or medical person, driver, whatever skill you is, you know, make the most of it. You'll have an awesome time in there. It's, you know, obviously a great way for to develop, you know, your discipline and structure with everything that you're doing. It makes a great mateship. You have a much deeper understanding of what teamwork is. And so, yeah, quite a walk away from my last activity, obviously. Yeah, but, yeah, a lot of skills do segue and carry over.
Yeah, well, speaking of being the best operator you can be, how did you feel when you found out you were going to be on Alone Australia Season 2?
Yeah, I remember that day, yeah. 10th of May, yeah, I got the call to say you've been selected after, you know, obviously quite a few different hoops didn't jump through and a few different assessments and things. But, yeah, I was pretty stoked. I kept it relatively quiet for that day and I went out and got a little bottle of bubbly. And then when the family were sitting around the table, I pulled out a couple of glasses and just sort of popped the cork and poured them and go, what's the occasion? And then one of them went, no way. And I said, yeah, yeah, lucky to have my family around me on that day. It was good, yeah.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. How did you feel when you found out it wasn't going to be in Australia?
My first thought was, okay, where is it? But then it's also, well, I guess it's an even playing field for everybody.
Mm.
The fact my schools, along with their schools, other competitors, they would be expecting it to be Australia most likely, and so therefore whatever knowledge base they have is irrelevant, as is mine. When you move to a different place, you're just evening up that. So, yeah, nothing wrong with that. And New Zealand, wow, spectacular place. I've had a couple of trips over there, a couple with the military, and I've been tumbled off a mountain over there and broke a few ribs and dislocated the shoulder.
Oh, no.
New Zealand and I, you know, we get on all right. We have a mutual understanding with each other, yeah.
You've been over there, but like you wouldn't say you're as familiar with the wildlife and the climate as much.
No, definitely not. You know, when you're over there with the military, it's about, you know, military tactics in snow and ice or whatever, and it might be, you know, always supplied with ration packs, so it's not about living off the land. But we do work with a lot of the specialised troops. We've done quite a few exercises with the New Zealand SAS, whether they come to Australia and we'll teach them survival skills here, or if you're working with them over there, they do tend to share their knowledge around the snow and ice environment. But a long time ago, too. So, it's, when time goes by, you look back and you think, oh, those skills are really prominent now, but I wouldn't have expected them to be. Yeah.
Yeah. They're making some crampons out of, you know, pieces of wood.
That's it.
You'd probably been preparing for something like this your whole life. What do you think were your greatest strengths going into the show?
I think the ability not to be flustered by things too much. You know, I didn't have
that anticipated feeling of what if this goes wrong or what if that happens. It was getting fairly clear in my mind what I thought my challenges would be, and being able to not put myself in a position where they were controlling my day, if you like. You know, it's like, you understand, okay, just keep your head space strong, you know, everything's good, you know, loving wife, you know, my sons, they're all stoked for me to be going, circumstances are good, enjoy the experience and take it where you want to take it, yeah.
Yeah, like, what do you reckon people kind of underestimate or misunderstand about survival situations?
In general, I think it would be the fact that survival is never really one big mistake. When somebody finds themselves in a survival situation, it's generally a series of small mistakes about might not be, you know, that topping up the fuel at the last roadhouse, and then you decide that it's like, oh, I'll cut through this arid country and I'll get to the next one and I'll fill up there, and you make a wrong turn, or, you know, that fuel gauge goes down quicker than you expect, just a series of small mistakes that compound, and then you find yourself thinking, okay, right, well, I don't have the water in the vehicle that I involved if I'm taking this road, and now your vehicle's overheating or punctured tyres, and it's like, okay, it's all stacking up now and things are very, very real, and they should have been considered before you made that decision. Yeah,
and that's it. People start to panic and impulse, and then everything gets worse.
Absolutely, yeah. And we all know it's like, you can be running late for, you know, somebody's party or something, you start driving fast and you make a wrong turn, and yeah, everything starts getting flustered, and instead of doing the opposite of just slowing down, take a deep breath, have a good look at the maps, get an understanding of where you're going, have a look at the sizing of the situation, and then progressing with a level thing. It's challenging even for the most experienced. When those things happen, you do need to think, okay, yeah, I can feel that element of stress or anxiety that could potentially build up, unless you stay on top of your headspace. And I guess that's always I picked up from the military. And of course, food is the other one. You have to believe the unknown quantity of how much food will be there.
Yeah, and I guess, like, you know, there's those skills, and there's also the actual, like, hard skills that you have and what you're capable of doing. You run survival courses. How do you balance the mental side with the physical hard skills side?
When I'm running when people think about survival and they think about courses, they probably, as often say, they think you're going to be running through the bush with a knife in your mouth, looking for food. The reality is food is so far down the priority list in a general survival situation, because we can go a long time without food. No one's ever died of starvation in Australia in a survival situation, but dehydration, everything else, it's about those priorities. So I make sure my courses are actually based more around education. You know, you can do it harder later if you wish, or if things go wrong, you understand what you'll be put up against, but making it a learning environment so you can learn about water, shelter, fire, food, communication, stars, ropes, knots, cutting edge tools. It's like, it doesn't end. There's a whole stack of skills that can be learned, and going along for one day event is not going to get teach you their skills. You need to invest a bit more time, invest a bit of money to learn those skills and then put them into practice like most things. If it's just knowledge, it's probably not going to serve you when you need it. You need to spend time out there and actually work those skills that you're learning.
Yeah, I noticed some of the courses you run, you do a father-son courses, and you also do like women kind of only courses. What's the thinking behind that?
Developed fairly organically, I suppose, without growing up with my biological father. He's been taken off when he was about, he was old to whatever he was deciding to do, but yeah, he was out of the picture. Then going through the foster care system when I eventually married my lovely wife, Neryl, and we had our kids, it was rather profound to sort of stop and think, what sort of father do you want to be? You don't necessarily have much to model it on, but you... Through those contrast and clarity, I could see a father and system that was broken growing up. And I thought, well, it's my opportunity to potentially be the best dad I could be and pass on skills and passion for nature and my aspects of culture that I find is important for my boys to know. And I'm proud to say, 24 and 27 these days, they're two very level-headed sons with great ambition for what they do, and very respectful young men. So it's job done, I suppose. I can put a tick there.
I was wondering if that was kind of part of the reason, and I love that idea of taking hardship and, you know, pushing against it.
using it to my advantage of understanding that your past doesn't have to equal your future. It can potentially hold you back if you let it, but taking aspects of it and growing and running with it. And that's where I guess I had other parents or community members say, hey, I think it's great what you're doing with father and son, but what about mother and daughter, or would you run one for a group of blokes, you know, tradies or whatever? And in the end, it's like, yeah, absolutely, I'd love to. And so running a women's event or a mother and daughter event, it's great. I make sure there's time for them. I have other facilitators or females come in, and you know, it might be like with a women's event, I have someone come in, a female, and it's a guy schooled at Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and I get to be the rag doll, and she shows the other women how to get out of the game system. For some of them, it can be quite confronting, because some of them may have had aspects of their life that could be quite an emotional a trigger, if you like. So working with that mindfully and making sure that's covered, that you're all more confident and empowered, connected to the country. I'm blown away at the skills that they develop. Like, most of the women will be able to light fire by friction by the end of an event, and often it's more women that can do it than men. But I'm not quite sure why, but it's empowering to see.
Oh, that's wonderful. I think some of our listeners who don't know about you would probably be surprised to find out that you've got a TikTok with 175,000 followers. How did you get into something that's, you know, seemingly so kind of anti-nature and like phone-based?
Yeah, for sure. I suppose that phrase of like social media and technology is like a necessary evil. It's not going anywhere, and I guess it's about utilizing, but at the same time, even myself as a parent, we're often saying to our teenagers, like, oh, you're always on your phones. I mean, you hop on any public transport and look around at the adults. They're the ones on the phones too, you know. And so it's about utilising and being aware that we can get trapped into spending too long on our devices, as we sit here talking on a device. But my son said, Dad, with all your, you know, survival skills, why don't you put some of this up on TikTok? Because he knew a lot of my focus is in and around youth, and a lot of what I do is about empowering youth and their community, and that, you know, spend more time out in that. And so I shared a few posts on TikTok about from survival, and one I put up about making soap from a particular bush called Alphafonia, and it sort of went a bit viral, and I think it had 1 million views by that night. And it's like, really? People are interested in that? I did realise then that I would probably have teenagers that would watch that. They might then go to their father or their uncle or whatever and go, hey, look at this guy doing this stuff. Can we go bush and camp and do some of the things that he's showing us here? And that's, you know, it's flattering to know, I suppose, that you might actually be an inspirational catalyst, I suppose, for people spending more time out bush or appreciating nature. Yeah.
I actually love it because, you know, I'd have loved to have this chat out on country with you, definitely. But like survival, often I feel people like think it's just, you know, stuffy kind of in books. Whereas on TikTok, you get to see it quite quickly, understand the physical nature of what you're doing, and that makes it so much more accessible.
I guess it does. But, I suppose I'm always mindful that I'm mindful of my audience as well. So obviously I don't swear on my TikToks and things like that, and I have a bit of banter and humour in there, which is part of me. But it's just being able to convey, I suppose, a love and respect for the land that we work with, it, not against it. You know, I've seen some of the circumstances in parts of Tassie, particularly growing up, as you see what's happening with the old growth forest down there, and it's under the skin to think, how can we be so naive that we can destroy our native growth forest? And it just goes against the principle of everything about, you know, working with the environment. It's the opposite. Yeah, so I'll segue off there, but I see that as being the opposite of what I do, where it's utilising the environment, but you're not there to destroy it. You're not there to, you know, root it for everything it's got and leave nothing for future generations. It's frustrating.
Yeah, that's the whole kind of idea behind We Are Explorers, is get people to see and care about it, and that's the only way people are going to want to protect it.
It is that, isn't it? You learn to love it. They can find with things that you may not like. You know, it might be, you know, spiders or snakes, but the more you know about it, the knowledge builds the fear, that psychology of fear, then you start to go, oh, wow, that one's really cool. I love that one. And before you know it, you have an admiration for those animals. They may not want to handle them, but you have a respect for the fact that they have their place in the environment, approaching on their world and make it for them.
Yeah. Well, Rick, it's been great to chat. I'm really excited to watch Alone Australia. Really excited to see your journey and see how much you bring kind of that TikTok energy into your filming.
Thank you. Yeah, looking forward to seeing it myself. And you guys keep up the great work. I love your posts. I've been following you guys for a while. So it's, really informative.
Thanks heaps. I do have one final question. What's your next adventure now that you're back?
I get the feeling it's going to be something to do with water and some form of documentary, I'm thinking.
Cool.
Probably a longer hike, living off the land, documenting it, water. Yeah, watch this space, I guess. I'm not quite sure exactly what it is yet, but I'm getting closer to it, yeah.
Oh, already looking forward to it. Sounds great.
Yeah, lovely.
All right, well, thanks, Rick. So there you have it. Hope you could hear Rick all right in that chat. You can find Rick on TikTok at Rick J. Peterson is his name, and he's got 176,000 followers now, actually. You can also find him on Instagram, where he's building a bit of presence there. Same thing, Rick J. Peterson, and he's got a website where you can find out more about his survival courses that he's running. Really love chatting to Rick, really appreciated coming on the show, and really excited to see how he goes in Alone Australia Season 2. I'm trying not to, look at the gaps of how long he was off his socials for to work out how long the season might be or how long he might have lasted for. It's all up in the air at the moment. We had to steer away from too much specific chat, of course, but yeah, really, really interesting, and I think he's going to be a really strong contender, so stay tuned. As always, if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a follow, give us a 5-star review, and share it with your mates. We're really trying to keep doing this. We're really loving it and getting in touch with the audience. So share around, let us know any of your feedback, any suggestions for guests, and we'll see you next time.